Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 739, Turkish Taffy, Part 3. This program is being recorded on April 10th of the year 2011. And I'm going to plunge right back in where we left off in Side 1. And again, I promise, I swear, no matter what happens, unless it's too drastic or too bloody, or unless I wind up getting filthy rich by some strange quirk of fate as a result of it, this is going to be the last show for a long time on the piggyback coups, etc., in the Middle East. I think it is consummately important. I don't regret having devoted this much time to it, but it has been sloppy and messy, and it has been a very difficult series to execute. We have been, so apologies if it's been a little bumpy or a little messy, but well, what can I say? Please don't shoot the piano player. He's doing the best he can. We're going to jump right in. This is an LA Times story by Jeffrey Fleischman from April 3rd of 2011. Islamists in Egypt seek change through politics. And there are some interesting things that have been taking place in Egypt since the uprisings. Skipping down. In 2005, 4 years after the government accepted Gamal al-Islamiyah's pledge to renounce violence, Ibrahim was released from prison. This is a fellow who was involved with the Muslim Brotherhood Gamal al-Islamiyah. They assassinated Anwar Sadat. They slaughtered a bunch of tourists at the Luxor temple. And again, now they are, quote, moderates, unquote, or so we're told. Anyway, returning to this segment. In 2005, 4 years after the government accepted Gamal al-Islamiyah's pledge to renounce violence, Ibrahim was released from prison. The Egypt he reentered was a different country. A young generation, adept at the trappings of Western technology, was restless for political expression and economic opportunity, not Islamic fanaticism. Skipping down. Critics regard reinvented Islamists such as Ibrahim as opportunists promising moderation while remaining privately committed to dangerous ultra-conservative ideals. He has denied in recent years that radicals in his group are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda. The 30,000 members, he said, support pluralism, including allowing Christian cops to join a political wing that Gamal al-Islamiyah plans to establish. And I would take that one with a generous grain of salt. And skipping down, this is what Mr. Ibrahim has to say. Again, this is the voice of moderation. Despite his eloquent phrases, however, Ibrahim, the unruly beard of his youth now threaded with gray, has limits on his vision of democracy. Similar to the beliefs held by the Muslim Brotherhood, he would not support a woman or a Copt as president, and he thinks the new constitution, like the existing one, must be rooted in Islamic law. A Copt could run as president, but Egypt is a Muslim nation and a Christian president would escalate tensions. Does France have a Muslim president, he said? I don't think a woman should be president. The Middle East is too complicated, unquote. Well, again, make of that what you will. What we're going to do next is to take a look at an article from the Asia Times. And this particular story is by Viktor Kotsev. And this is a long article called Egypt Moved by Deep Waters. And it ruminates about some of the dynamics that may be unfolding politically in Egypt. And in particular, it talks about some disturbing indications that maybe things are not going to be as moderate as we're told. Also, the most important aspect of this particular article is the theory of the author. And this is a theory apparently held by a number of observers on the Egyptian political scene, that in fact what the Islamist parties, the Muslim Brotherhood in particular, are hoping to do is to have a secular coalition government that fails because of its inability to deal with any meaningful reform and revamping of the economy. In other words, if a liberal secular government, if a secular coalition comes to power, and if they are unable to handle economic matters and social reform, then they will catch the blame. And the theory here is that the Islamists intend exactly that to take place, that they want a secular coalition to take the fall for being unable to govern Egypt and unable to straighten out the Egyptian economy. I would suggest that it is in this regard that the Republican Party, itself allied with the Muslim Brotherhood through Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, and elements we've talked about in this and other series, I would suggest that they view Barack Obama in exactly the same way. They want Obama to fail. So, in fact, they've been pretty explicit about that. But in this regard, I think the GOP and their Muslim Brotherhood allies are viewing respectively the Obama administration and a potential secular coalition government in Egypt in the same way. They want it to fail, fail economically, fail socially, and therefore fail politically. And the vacuum that is left, they see as ushering them into power. So again, an Asia Times story, Egypt Moved by Deep Waters by Viktor Kotzev. The URL will be available in the description for the program. On Wednesday, 11 days skipping down in the story, on Wednesday, 11 days after Egyptians voted in their first referendum on amendments to the 1971 Constitution, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, or SCAF, which has held the lion's share of power in the country since the ouster of Mubarak, issued an Interim Constitutional Declaration, or ICD. In an ironic twist, the referendum and the declaration pitted the old enemies, the Muslim Brotherhood and Mubarak's National Democratic Party, or NDP, against the liberal youth movement. The liberals were particularly disappointed by the ICD, pointing out that the declaration includes 80% of the old constitution, including an, quote, outdated socialist quota, unquote, stipulating that half of the seats in the parliament are reserved for workers and farmers. A lot of ambiguity remained concerning when and by whom a more permanent solution would be drafted and what that would look like. Any modification or amendment of the current constitution will not achieve the aspirations of the people, unquote, said Ayman Nour, one of the leaders of the youth movement and former presidential candidate, in a recent interview with Arshak al-Assad. At this point, the ICD was not a major surprise. The declaration followed, with some additions, the amendments considered at the referendum. Again, Islamists viewed that, and other observers viewed that as a victory for the Brotherhood and other Islamists. Tension has been brewing for some time now, and another leader of the liberals, Mohammed el-Baradei, was physically attacked by Islamists during the voting. The January 25th Revolutionary Youth Coalition, including el-Baradei and Nour, largely voted no in the polls over concerns that the changes were insufficient and would not allow enough time for the opposition to organize for the elections. By the way, parenthetically, I would note that in the newscasts in this country, and I heard some broadcast, I heard a CBS News affiliate broadcast, initially the attackers of Mohammed el-Baradei were described as, excuse me, members of the Mubarak political party, the New Democratic Party, and this article describes them as Islamists, which is sort of what I had expected, frankly. So interesting that now, although initially the attackers of Mohammed el-Baradei, who prevented him from voting, according to some accounts, were described as supporters of the NDP, that is Mubarak's party, now they're described in this article, or they are described in this article, as Islamists. Continuing with this Asia Times story, the amendments, which opened the way for parliamentary and presidential elections this summer, benefited unfairly already established parties such as the NDP and the Muslim Brotherhood, the liberals claimed. The 25th of January, on the other hand, considers itself a movement and lacks grassroots party structures that are of vital importance in elections. It has threatened to organize a new million-man protest on Friday, April 8th, if broad demands, including tougher measures against former Mubarak regime officials, are not met. Previously, I projected that the army and the Muslim Brotherhood may prop up, by the way, this is the author of this Asia Times article, not yours truly, beginning again. Previously, I projected that the army and the Muslim Brotherhood may prop up a secular democratic government with the hopes of using it as a scapegoat when the economy takes a turn to the worse, the political reforms stagnate, and disillusionment sets in. Despite the spike in tensions, this is still a possibility, and it is important to note that the three main presidential candidates so far, Amer Moussa, Mohammed el-Baradei, and Ayman Nour, are representatives of the liberal opposition. Moussa, who was Secretary General of the Arab League and a former Egyptian prime minister, is considered the front-runner in this still informal race. His approach to the amendments has also been the more conciliatory than that of El-Baradei and Nur. A government without a real power base is a disaster for democracy at a minimum, and most likely for the general well-being of society as a whole. The alternatives are not very good or clear either. Meanwhile, sectarian violence is soaring. 13 people were killed in clashes between Muslims and Coptic Christians in Cairo on March 9th, an incident that came on the heels of several deadly attacks against Copts, who make up at least 10% of Egypt's population in the last months. By the way, Copts, as indicated, is a Christian sect in Egypt. More recently on Sunday, a group of terrorists attacked the Egypt-Israel natural gas pipeline for the second time in 2 months. The bomb they planted failed to explode. Other worrisome internal developments include reports that women protesters were subjected to torture and humiliation by the army last month, including pseudoscientific forced virginity tests. Skipping down, Egypt's recent foreign policy choices may raise many questions as well. Most analysts have argued that Mubarak's ouster was beneficial for a more active Egyptian involvement in the region, and indeed there are signs of activity, but those are confusing and worrisome signs. Egypt announced that it would not interfere in Libya, quote, for reasons linked to our internal security and the large number of Egyptians present, unquote, but consistent reports are coming in that Cairo is deeply involved in supplying weapons to the rebels in Benghazi. Moreover, in the beginning of the Libya crisis, the prestigious American think tank Stratfor cited sources claiming that Egypt's special forces had repeatedly entered its western neighbor's territory. And it remains to be seen exactly where this is going to be going. There is considerable speculation in this story that ultimately Egypt and Turkey may begin competing for the sentiments of the Muslim peoples in the Middle East, the Arab world in particular. Skipping down, Turkey and Egypt are two major Muslim powers in the Mediterranean and have historically competed for influence over the Arab and Muslim world. Some have speculated that their rivalry might lead them to intervene in other countries in the region that are experiencing unrest, and thus to step in for the United States, whose influence is in decline. How exactly their relationship will develop is uncertain. Independently from these other crises, Egypt is facing a challenge to its south. On Wednesday, and consider this in the context of the region as a whole, on Wednesday, Ethiopia announced plans to build a large dam on the Nile despite Egypt's and the Sudan's claims to most of the water of the river. The latter claims are based on treaties that date back to colonial times and six upstream countries, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Burundi, have for years called for these treaties to be revised. The dispute is particularly bitter in light of the severe water crisis that is plaguing the entire region, and according to Reuters, there are concerns that it may spark a war, unquote. So again, in addition to the grinding economic problems that are going to have to be solved, water and the possibility of war with other countries over that water is going to be really interesting indeed. Again, I would note that the theory was sounded in that article that what the Muslim Brotherhood would like to see would be, and perhaps also the New Democratic Party of Hosni Mubarak, would be to see a secular coalition, a liberal, in the American sense of the word, liberal secular coalition fail, paving the way in the disillusionment and chaos that follows the economic and social failure of such a coalition for the Muslim Brotherhood to come to power and an Islamic fascist government to come in to, well, basically to emerge on the Egyptian and perhaps other Middle Eastern scenes. Now, very quickly, the moderation that we're being told the former assassins and terrorists have embraced, well, that may be the case. I would also suggest that it may just be an outright lie, and that one of the reasons they may be touting their moderation is so they ultimately can not only succeed politically but militarily. I'm going to reread very quickly from WMD Insights of November of 2006. Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood presses government for nuclear weapons. The political goal stated in this particular excerpt that I'm going to read may very well account for the espousal of moderation. Certainly, if they want to get their hands on nuclear technology, the Muslim Brotherhood is going to have to espouse moderation. How moderate does this sound? In the summer of 2006, after pressing the Egyptian government for more than a year to restart the country's nuclear power program, the Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt's foremost political opposition force, escalated its nuclear goals and openly called for Egypt to develop nuclear weapons as a counterweight to Israel's nuclear capabilities. Against this background, the group reacted with little enthusiasm to the mid-September announcement by Jamal Mubarak, the son of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, that Egypt would revive its peaceful nuclear power program without declaring that Egypt would build a nuclear deterrent. In 2005, revival of the Egyptian nuclear power program had been a rallying cry for the Muslim Brotherhood. In its 2005 parliamentary election platform, for example, it had declared that under its leadership, Egypt would develop, quote, special national programs such as the nuclear program, the space and aviation program, armaments program, and the biotechnology program, unquote. And skipping down. By May 17, 2006, Brotherhood deputies were openly attacking the Mubarak government for not pursuing an active nuclear program. Ikhwan Online, the official website of the Muslim Brotherhood, stated that the Brotherhood, quote, deputies accused the government of abandoning the nuclear program and being content with not building atomic power plants for peaceful purposes and electricity production at the same time as, The Brotherhood stated that deputies accused the government of abandoning the nuclear power program and being content with not building atomic power plants for peaceful purposes and electricity production at the same time that many other countries such as India advanced in this field. And again, the Brotherhood was very critical of the Mubarak government for not building nuclear weapons. Certainly, if they want to get their hands on nuclear technology, then they're going to have to profess, quote, moderation, unquote. A story, by the way, talking about Turkey, a couple of stories that have been completely blacked out in the American media. This is from the Hurriyet Daily News, a Turkish website, actually Turkish newspaper. This is from March 24th of 2011, Özgür Ögret, Turkish police raid printing house and erase unpublished book. Istanbul police raided a printing house Wednesday evening in search of computer files containing an unpublished book by an arrested subject in the Ergenekon coup plot case and erased the digital draft. The printing house, Itaki, was the publisher that owned the rights to İmam Ordusu, The Army of the Imam, an unpublished book by journalist Ahmed Sik, who was arrested 2 weeks ago. The book was found in digital form on a computer at the office of the dissident online news portal O.TV. Sika stated he did not know how it got there, calling the staff of the website people he would not stand together with in any case. Sik's arrest has been criticized in legal circles since the evidence against him was not revealed to his lawyers. Sik's unpublished book His unpublished book deals with the alleged organization founded within the Turkish police by the Fethullah Gulen religious community. This fact has led to suspicions that Sik was arrested due to the book's contents rather than his involvement in the alleged Ergenekon gang, which he has worked as a journalist to expose. Ergenekon prosecutor Zekeriya Oz has said Sik was not arrested due to his book. Well, the Ergenekon coup plot was an alleged coup plot in which secular army officers were seen as plotting against the, quote, moderate, unquote, Islamist government in Turkey. The theory here is that he was nominally linked, that the author arrested here and whose book was erased was linked to the Ergenekon coup plot specifically as sort of a misdirection play. In fact, his book was talking about the influence within the Turkish police of a Turkish Islamist Imam Ordusu, or basically a Turkish Islamist, Mr. Gulen, and more about Mr. Gulen, G-U-L-E-N. There's an umlaut over the U. Now, again, this is something that has received no coverage in the American media. I have never heard of this particular organization or this individual, but again, the Turkish police just raided a publishing house and erased a book called The Army of the Imam in English, and this book was talking about the influence within the Turkish police of this, quote, moderate, unquote, Islamist community. Apparently, this same, quote, moderate, unquote, Islamist community has influence in the U.S., and again, perhaps they truly are moderates. I have no idea. Generally, moderate organizations don't seek influence in the police, however. But apparently, this organization has gained the attention or garnered the attention of the FBI. Again, from the Hurriyet Daily News of March 21st of 2011, an article, FBI investigating Gulen schools in the U.S. These are charter schools, apparently 100-plus of them, set up in the U.S. by the same organization that was the focal point of that book, which talked about its influence, setting up secret influence within the Turkish police. This story reads in part, the FBI and other U.S. federal agencies have been investigating whether a Turkish religious community operating hundreds of schools worldwide is involved in visa fraud to bring teachers from Turkey to the United States. The claim was made in a broad analysis by the Philadelphia Inquirer on religious leader Fethullah Gulen, who the paper describes as a major Islamic political figure in Turkey, unquote, and the more than 120 charter schools in the United States that are linked to his movement. Religious scholars consider the Gulen strain of Islam moderate, and the investigation has no link to terrorism. Rather, it, the investigation, is focused on whether hundreds of Turkish teachers, administrators, and other staffers employed under the H-1B visa program are misusing taxpayer money, the newspaper wrote. H-1B visas are meant to be reserved for workers with highly specialized skill sets. Skipping down, Gulen, who has been living in the United States since 1999, is a Turkish religious leader whose movement is considered one of the strongest fronts in the civilian struggle for power in Turkey, especially because of its influence over state structures in the country. So apparently the Gulen sect or organization or the followers of Mr. Gulen have considerable influence within the state structures of Turkey, including the Turkish secret police. And again, there has been something of a struggle between reactionary elements within the army that are secular and the, quote, moderate, unquote, Turkish Islamists of Mr. Erdogan. And so again, you know, how moderate the Gulen strain of Islam is, I do not know. But I think it's interesting that the Turkish secret police just erased a book that alleges that it's developing influence within that very same organization. And I would note that they have 120 charter schools here in the United States now being investigated by the FBI. One beneficiary, and I think this too, is likely to lead to war and bloodshed. One of the beneficiaries of the coups appears to be Hezbollah. Once again, an Asia Times story, a two-parter called Arab Revolts Handed to Hezbollah by Chris Zambellis. I'm only going to read a short section of this story. As the surge of revolutionary fervor has taken the greater Middle East by storm continues to spread, many observers are grappling with the political uncertainties the tumult has produced from Morocco to the Persian Gulf and beyond. The popular uprisings that prompted the ouster of the dictatorships in Tunisia and Egypt and threatened the panoply of authoritarian despots clinging to power in other countries have already had a profound effect on regional politics. Despite their highly fluid nature, it is not too early to assess the impact of these events on the position of prominent actors such as Lebanon's Hezbollah. The movement's place amid the unfolding arrest bears special relevance considering the open hostility that has characterized its relations with the recently toppled Hosni Mubarak regime and other governments threatened by the wave of protest. The popularity Hezbollah enjoys among a large segment of the very same people who have taken to the streets to demand political freedoms, rule of law, representative government, and economic opportunities adds another dynamic worth closer examination. Hezbollah, very simply, is a Shia group. I would characterize them as Shia Islamic fascists. They stem from the Disciples of Islam, or the Devotees of Islam, rather, which is a Shia offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, again, one that was inspired by alliance with the Axis powers in World War II. If indeed Hezbollah is a gain, it gains materially from the piggyback coups, it stands to reason that ultimately war in the Middle East will be one of the outgrowths of that. One of the points that I want to note is that the more chaos and the more war or potential warfare develop as a result of this, up goes the price of oil. That hurts small and middle-sized people and institutions all over the world, but it helps big ones. It helps the petroleum industry in particular. When the price of oil goes up, it leads to inflation, and people who aren't wealthy get squeezed the hardest by inflation. Those who are most wealthy are squeezed the least. So in effect, the more the price of oil goes up and the more inflation goes up, it's a form of brutal worldwide social Darwinism. Ultimately, poor folks are going to suffer and ultimately die. But watch out if major warfare and or terrorism result from Hezbollah's gaining as a result of what's taking place in the Middle East. Again, watch the political firestorm that Barack Obama and the Democrats catch as a result of this. By the way, something else that I'm going to include in a description of the program, but not I've not included in the broadcast themselves. The Obama administration had selected Frank Wisner Jr. as a special envoy to the Middle East, and yet he wound up speaking on behalf of Hosni Mubarak remaining in power, thereby discrediting and, to an extent, diplomatically destabilizing the Obama administration. I would hearken back to some of my rumination concerning the two State Departments and the two CIAs, as John Loftus characterized them, and the notion advanced by yours truly that in these piggyback coups, that binary CIA and the binary State Department are becoming manifest, and that the Republican slash GOP slash underground Reich faction of the State Department and the CIA are actively destabilizing the Obama administration. I suspect that many of the leaks that are making their way to WikiLeaks has much to do with that. In that context, we're going to close with an article about WikiLeaks. Apparently, WikiLeaks has disclosed information indicating that the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, had developed working relationships with the Secret Services of some of the countries now being the unrest is now taking place. One can, it's difficult to imagine a constructive motive for leaking something like this, further destabilization of these countries and perhaps pushing them towards joining an anti-Israel coalition, which ultimately could realize the Third and Underground Reich's goals of exterminating world Jewry and ultimately, too, an entity that's seen as the parent or a subject of world Jewry, namely the United States, that could very well be an outgrowth of these events. From the Ynet News website, the full URL will be available in the description for the program. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange released additional classified documents about Israel and the Middle East. Britain's Guardian newspaper stated that the sensitive documents expose, among other things, Israeli criticism of the man who is de facto head of state in Egypt, Hussein Tantawi, chairman of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. And the article goes on to describe basically Israeli / Mossad relationships with Bahrain's Secret Service and also some statements by U.S. diplomats attributed to Israel, which can only serve to drive the uprisings there further to the right and in an anti-Israeli, pro-Islamist, and ultimately lethal direction. There are things I've alluded to that will be in the description for the record program number 739. This is a huge subject we've been covering. It will continue to unfold. We're going to be turning our attention to other subjects in immediate broadcast, coming back to this as the situation dictates. This concludes side two of For the Record program number 739, Turkish Taffy, part three. This is being recorded on April 10th of the year 2011. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.